machine without feelings. Do you think that because I am poor, obscure, plain and little, that I am soulless and heartless? I have as much soul as you and full as much heart. And if God had blessed me with beauty and wealth, I could make it as hard for you to leave me as it is for I to leave you.
Welcome to the Story Grid Editor Roundtable Podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better writer, following the Story Grid method developed by Sean Coyne, an editor with over 25 years' experience. My name is Valerie Francis, and I'll be moderating the roundtable. I'm also traveling today. I'm in Los Angeles for Robert McKee's Genre Week seminar. So since I'm not in my studio, I'm recording on my laptop. And as you can hear, the sound quality isn't as good as it usually is, but that's okay. We're just going to roll with it this week. Joining me today are four of my fellow certified Story Grid editors, and they are in their studios. Jari Bolander, Anne Holly, Kim Kessler, and Leslie Watts. Each week, one of us proposes a favorite movie that they think will be a great example of a key story principle. That editor has to make the case for their position with the help of a partner, while two of us play devil's advocate to check the validity of the proposition. This week, Kim pitched Jane Eyre as an example of a framing story narrative device. This 2011 adaptation of the 1847 Gothic romance novel by Charlotte Bronte was directed by Kari Joji Fukunaga from a screenplay by Maura Buffini. Kim will be ably assisted on the A-team by Anne, while Leslie and Jari will make up the B-team. They're going to test the theory by evaluating it separately and from other perspectives, so that in the end, we get a complete 360-degree view of the story principle of a framing story as a narrative device. Okay, Kim, she's going to start us off with a look at the genre, of course, because we're story nerds and we can't stop talking about genre, and a quick one-sentence summary of each of the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff. Kim.
So the genre here is tricky, and we're going to talk about it a little bit. So it's, I would say it's a love story, and it's also a deeply internal, and I'm going with status admiration. It may be status sentimental. I'm having a little trouble telling them apart in this specific instance. So anyway, we'll get to that. Don't worry about it. So let's jump in here to the beginning hook. Jane Eyre runs away from a great house on foot and crying. She travels a long way and collapses on a doorstep where she is taken in by a parishioner and his two sisters. When asked her name, Jane flashes back to her tormented childhood. She answers with a false name, Jane Elliot, and refuses to give any details about her past. Instead, she asks for help finding work. When St. John offers her a job teaching at a country schoolhouse, she happily accepts, even though she is highly overqualified for the position. In the middle build, after enduring a painful childhood, a grown Jane Eyre arrives at Thornfield Hall to begin her new position as a governess. She meets the owner, the surly Mr. Rochester, who seems to enjoy verbally sparring with her. After Jane saves Mr. Rochester from a fire in his room, she endures much mystery, tension, and mixed signals from Mr. Rochester until he reveals his true feelings and proposes to her, and Jane happily accepts. But on the day of their wedding, she finds out that Mr. Rochester is already married, and his wife Bertha suffers from mental illness and has been the great mystery that lives at Thornfield Hall. Rochester begs Jane to live with him anyway, even if they can't be legally married, but she refuses and leaves in the night on foot. In the ending payoff, Jane has been working at the country schoolhouse for some time when St. John discovers her real name from a drawing of hers and returns with news that a solicitor has been looking for her. Her uncle has died and has left her a great inheritance. She shares the money with St. John and his sisters, and when St. John announces that he wants to marry Jane to make her a missionary wife, she refuses and returns to Thornfield, where she finds it burned down from a fire set by Bertha. Mr. Rochester is alive but is now blind due to his refusal to leave Thornfield until safely ensuring everyone is out. He couldn't save Bertha, who jumped from the rooftop. Jane returns to him and promises to never be parted from him again.
Thank you, Kim. Okay, now I want to hear all about Jane Eyre as a great example of a framing story as a narrative device. Why don't you take us through that?
So a narrative device is a specific method used by the writer to convey what they want. So they're just different ways for us to share the information that we really want to share, when we want to share it, how we want to share it. So it's a strategy that we use so we can inform our reader or our audience of what we feel like they need to be told. It is the way the story is told. So often this involves the sequence of events and in which order we deliver that to the audience. The information that the audience learns first greatly impacts the way they experience the story, as does the information that is withheld from the audience. And all of this certainly attributes to the narrative drive, which we discussed in detail last week when we talked about Get Out. So, in our current film, Jane Eyre, which is an adaptation of a classic novel, this version of the film is told very differently than the book was originally. And it changes the experience of the story. So the novel is told linearly from starting with Jane's childhood up through the ending of the story, but the film version is told within a framing story. Comparing them is a very interesting exercise because both stories work really, really well. So if they both work, then how the heck do you choose what device to use? And so we're going to talk about this, but first let's go ahead and take a look at the details of Jane Eyre, the film. As we talked about, the beginning hook, this is beginning at the all is lost moment, dark night of the soul, when Jane is leaving Thornfield Hall and she's running away on foot. Clearly she's upset. She is on the moors and she's sleeping and crying and it's raining and it's awful. And we're all wondering, well, why did she leave and where is she going and what's happened? Then she arrives at Moor House, where St. John and his sisters live, and they take her in, and she begins working at the country schoolhouse for girls and that kind of thing. However, in this whole beginning hook, there are flashbacks to her past, and it jumps back and forth between present, when she's at Moor House with St. John and his sisters, to the past in her childhood, and it does this four times. So we begin at this dark night of the soul. She arrives at St. John's home. Then we flash back to her childhood, where her awful cousin, John Reed, is tormenting her. And then we see that her aunt despised her, sent her to Lowood School. And then we jump back to the present again. And St. John and his sisters are, you know, wanting to know who can they contact to help her. And this is where she says, there's no one in my life. My name's Jane Elliott. I just need work. Like, just help me work. And St. John asks about her childhood, her education from this school. And did she have a thorough education? At which point we are back with Jane as a child at Lowood School. And we see the abuse and the awful circumstances that happened at that time. And Jane losing her beloved friend, Helen. And then again, we jump back to the present at Moor House and then back to the past. So it's doing this kind of back and forth, getting us through Jane's childhood in a fairly efficient manner while layering in this mystery of, okay, this is Jane as a young girl. How then does she come to be grown and then running away from this great house? And it, you know, it sets this up where we're not really sure what to expect. So the beginning hook ends in the past, where we see Jane is a grown woman and she's leaving Lowood School. And all the young girls there are saying, you know, goodbye, Miss Eyre, goodbye, Miss Eyre. And they all love her very, very much. And then we see the one mean teacher that was there ever since she was a small girl. And they have a very cold shoulder to one another. But Jane kindly says, you know, goodbye. And she arrives at Thornfield Hall and she meets Mrs. Fairfax and learns who she's going to be a governess for. And also learns that Mr. Rochester is the actual owner of the property. And it ends with her in her very own room with a fire lit. And it's all very lovely. And she smiles. We actually see Jane smile. So it brings us to where the novel would kick us into the middle build as well. So it's interesting the way that the beginning hooks are different, but they kind of end up accomplishing the same thing by getting us to the point in the story where Jane arrives at Thornfield Hall. Okay, so in the film, the middle build is strictly linear story. We just pick up and continue with Jane arriving at Thornfield Hall. And her first day there, she meets Mr. Rochester on the road, spooks his horse, and he falls and is very grumpy about it. And she doesn't know that he is Mr. Rochester. And it's this very kind of a little fun moment of the comedy of errors there. And, you know, it continues through, you know, she saves Mr. Rochester from the fire, the arrival of Miss Ingram, the rival, that's very funny. And The midpoint is the arrival of Richard Mason, which we find out is actually Mr. Rochester's brother-in-law. And, you know, he's attacked. Again, there's this great mystery going on. We're not sure what's happening. There's this woman who seems to be laughing in the hall. There's all these things. You know, Jane gets a letter from her aunt, and she returns to her and finds out she actually does have a living relative. Mr. Rochester finally proposes. There's the botched wedding where we find out the truth that Mr. Rochester was actually married, and we learn all about Mr. Rochester's wife. Now we are back to the beginning of the story where we realize, oh, this is why Jane leaves. She needs to get herself out of that wedding dress as quickly as possible. Mr. Rochester begs her to stay, and it's a very emotional scene because of Jane's inner moral code and her inner moral compass that she must adhere to. She cannot and will not stay. And so then we see her again back to the beginning where she leaves in the night and she's on the moors and that kind of thing. Then the ending payoff, it returns to the present where we left Jane in the beginning hook, where she's teaching at the school, that country schoolhouse. She's been teaching there for a while. St. John stops by to see her and notices that her name on one of her drawings is Jane Eyre, not Jane Elliott. And from there, he's able to piece together things because he saw an ad from a solicitor that it was her uncle looking for her. He's died, left her this great inheritance, and onward through the end of the story where, you know, Jane does not want to go to India and marry St. John. She returns to Rochester. And even though there's a very tragic ending there, it's also very beautiful because love triumphs no matter what, you know, no matter the distance, no matter the time, no matter the disability or any of those things, their connection is so pure and wonderful. So I have a scene list breakdown. There's a link in the show notes. I put it on a spreadsheet, scene by scene in the film, and you know, what's in the past, what's in the present, and pointing out, you know, the Five Commandments and those kinds of things in there. So comparing all of that to the novel, which is, again, linear and straightforward, the original title of the book was Jane Eyre, an autobiography, and it was written in first person, and it begins from, you know, her young childhood and up through, you know, the end of the story, which goes further than this film does. So in the, you know, the beginning hook in the novel is going to be Jane's childhood and her time at Lowood School. The middle build is going to be Thornfield Hall. And the ending payoff is, you know, these other employment that she does and the proposals, both from, you know, St. John, et cetera. And it's going to end further along with her and Mr. Rochester. They marry, they do have children, and he does regain a little bit of his sight. So even with the nonlinear storytelling, the events themselves are mostly laid out the same, but bringing that portion of the ending payoff to the beginning hook creates a very different feeling for the story and the audience. So let's just consider how this structural change, you know, affects the story. So this is where I'm talking about genre. In the original novel, it feels much more like a global status story because we really follow Jane from her childhood all the way up. And we see, you know, really the traumatic circumstances that she was raised in, both with her aunt and at the school, and this, you know, and her just enduring inner self-respect and inner maturity. She's just a very fascinating character. She recognizes hypocrisy and calls it out, and she, you know, refuses to settle. She has a deep passion for life. She refuses to compromise it, and she aches for life and aches for passion, even though she is stoic and plain in these all these ways that other people perceive her, but that's not who she really is, which of course is what Mr. Rochester sees. So in this story, the way that it is set up, it feels more like it's framed as a love story, even though, again, the beginning hook is still very much, you know, we don't meet Mr. Rochester in the beginning hook. So again, it still very well could be a global status story. I'm having trouble pulling them apart. It's one of those ones where I might be too close to it. And I really, really do just love it so much that it's hard to see things separately because I just see Jane and Rochester. But again, if one version of, you know, linear storytelling tells one global story and the other version tells a different global story, that's very interesting. And it's something that we can think about with our own stories. What global story are you trying to tell? Which one's going to be primary and which one's going to be the supporting role? And how can your narrative device help you really hit what you're trying to hit and make it really, really clear? Conventions and obligatory scenes, depending on which one's global, is going to really depend on, you know, that's going to determine which of these you really need to make sure is clear to the audience. Point of view and narrative device, certainly this is one of the most dramatic changes that we see in this, which Anne is going to talk about in just a moment. But we do see, you know, considering the novel was in first person and this story is very much this third person telling and what that does for narrative drive, you know, suspense, mystery, or dramatic irony. The wants and needs are going to be the same because we still have an external love story and an internal status story happening. But again, kind of how they played out together is a little bit different depending on which one is global. And that brings us to this controlling idea. If the global story switches to being the supporting story, if they swap, our theme statement can shift. And so what all of this means is that the meaning that the audience is going to take away from a story will feel different because one is going to feel like it's playing first place versus the other one's a supporting role. And so whichever one feels more global is going to be the more of the meaning that the audience takes away. Love prevails when versus, you know, success prevails when. And then the most different here, the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff, which are certainly different. Mostly it's just the beginning hook here that's different because we've brought in pieces of the ending payoff and brought it to the front to create this level of mystery. So all of that to say, it's really interesting to consider these two different mediums, you know, film versus a novel, as well as the two different time periods in which they were written. You know, the original novel was published in 1847 and this film was made in 2011. And both of those things, you know, the medium as well as the time frame seem to contribute to the writer's intention of what they were trying to do with the story, what they aim to do, how they do it, the devices that they choose to use to accomplish it. It seems to me that in 2011, telling a story, this kind of story, a very deeply internal story, it helps to show Jane as an adult at the beginning so that a modern audience can identify with her as an adult right away and then be interested in her childhood, where in 1847, and certainly still a modern audience, we all, you know, I can't say we all love the novel, but a majority of us, we really do love the novel the way that it is, but they're doing different things and that's okay. And it seems, again, very intentional.
I started watching the BBC 1983 production of this story after I finished watching the movie because I felt like watching more. And one of the reasons that it was a very good choice for the movie to start with Jane as an adult and minimize the time as a child, which really became clear in the 1983 BBC version, is that it's very hard to find a child actor good enough to carry off Jane's childhood. And it wasn't very good in the 1983 version. I need to make full disclosure here. I absolutely love this novel. I'm a huge fan of 19th century novels in general. And ordinarily, I don't like cinematic adaptations because they have to squeeze down this Victorian sensibility into this little two-hour entertaining capsule. So that said, I can appreciate what they did here. For one thing, just the sheer visual beauty of the filmmaker's eye on the landscape of Northern England and so forth is just wonderful. And also the filmmakers had to make some very hard decisions about what to focus on and what to discard. And that always happens when you adapt a long novel to a relatively short movie. So they discarded or seriously shorthanded a lot of key ideas and moments in the novel. And I know Leslie's going to take this up a little bit more later, but that is an adapter's job. So the film adaptation of a novel is a very specific job. And I think studying films adapted from novels that you already know well is an excellent way to understand the huge differences between a novel and a screenplay. Not just this novel and this screenplay, but between the concept of a novel and the concept of a screenplay. And to help you as a writer make conscious choices about how you want to write, whether you're writing a screenplay or writing a novel. So the novel, as Kim has said, is narrated linearly and in the first person as quote unquote an autobiography, which it's not, but it was a device that Charlotte Bronte used. The movie starts at Jane's all is lost moment and then moves backward and forward in time, as Kim has explained. So the choice on the part of the screenwriter to start at the all is lost moment, which I agree is an all is lost moment of a love story because it starts when the lovers have broken up, had a couple of interesting effects that I think every story writer should think about. The first is the effect on the point of view. And I really want to bring this out. It is hard to imagine the first person narrator, Jane, in the novel, telling her story in that nonlinear fashion. In a sense, it would require a kind of lying or withholding, because of course, the first person narrator has to know what happened and how she came to be alone and starving in a rainstorm on the Yorkshire Moor. Not telling us would have felt coy or sly, like I'm just not telling you something. So we know, we would know in that case that she knows what happens, and we would feel as readers like we were being strung along or cheated with this artificial suspense. Now, that device can work, I think, in sort of light comedic or sort of ironic stories, or sort of arch stories, where the first person narrator simply says, hang on, to explain how I came to be clinging to a spar in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, I have to take you back to the beginning. That is not the tone of a serious dramatic piece. It can work, and it's wonderful when it does, but in this case, it wouldn't have worked for Jane's story. So when you have this serious dramatic piece cast in a more or less natural reality, you probably can't get away with being that arch. The second effect of the nonlinear narrative device also has to do with narrative drive. We keep talking about narrative drive, and we're all really interested in it right now, so we're just going to keep talking about it. When Rochester proposes to Jane, it's about two-thirds of the way into the story, and she accepts, we get a powerful dose of two narrative drives at once. It took me a minute to kind of sort it out in my mind, so let me give it a shot here. On the one hand, there's dramatic irony. It's pretty straightforward. We already know, because of the way this movie has been set up, that Jane's all is lost moment is still to come, right? And she doesn't know it yet at this point in her timeline, but we do. It hasn't happened yet for her, but we know because we've already seen her future, because this third person narrator is telling the story out of sequence. So that's dramatic irony. We know something that the character doesn't know. On the other hand, and this is a really curious effect and something for writers to think about, the movie has a kind of narrator of its own, and it's not Jane in the first person. It's kind of this distant third-person view of Jane and her life, which is characterized at the very beginning by the distant camera watching her from above, going across the moor in the rain, and finally kind of honing in on her. But it's very distant third-person at first. And so it has this distant third-person view of Jane and her life. And that sort of a meta narrator of the story becomes like another person. And this person, because the director was a he, knows the whole story, the beginning, the middle, and the end. And we, at the beginning, have no idea how Jane gets from this happy marriage proposal that we're now seeing two-thirds of the way into the story to being alone and starving on the moor, right? She doesn't even suspect that it's going to happen, but this narrator, quote unquote, knows it all, right? And in a curious way, that meta narrator, that meta character, I guess you could say, creates mystery because that quote unquote person or that quote unquote character who is the kind of the camera knows something that we don't know, and that's mystery. So why is this important? Because although this is a love story, I vote that this is really a global love story, and therefore technically an external genre, it is very internal, very slow moving, very intensely emotional. So the internal genre is very strong. There isn't a great deal of external action. There's a fire and some running across the moor, but it is an internal story. So the mystery that is set up by making the all is lost moment, the opening scene, adds a drive to a story that in its own day, in the middle of the 19th century, did just fine on suspense alone, where we find out everything that Jane learns exactly as she finds it out. But it might be difficult for modern audiences to sit through. So it was a masterful choice on the part of the screenwriter to open with that device of starting with the all is lost moment so that it creates both mystery and suspense plus dramatic irony at the core. So sort of one of the core love story scenes, that proposal scene that drives us through the ending payoff.
This is fascinating. I could listen to this for ages.
Me too.
I really could.
I'll just talk and talk and talk.
It's really fun to be the moderator because I get a more macro view of what's going on. When you're one of the team members, you have to drill right down into the story. And of course, you know, I'm very competitive, so I like to, I like to really make my case. But this week I get to sort of sit back and listen to the arguments that you guys are making, and it's really cool. So I'm really curious to see, to hear what Jari and Leslie are going to have to say about this. Jari, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, sure. So full disclosure, I didn't really like this movie at all. For me, I actually like these kind of movies, but this one was confusing. And the reason why it was confusing is that I know what the writer and the director tried to do. They wanted to modernize the tale of this very classical book, autobiographical type construct, where the original story is linear and this one is basically nonlinear. And there's some debate about how to go about doing this, because when you look at a story like this, you can have some types of narrative drive or framing of how you're going to tell the story. In this particular case, they were attempting to use more of a framing type of narrative, which doesn't really work. And the reason why it doesn't work is because framing stories are basically stories within stories. And when it gets muddled is when you have this nonlinear storytelling and sort of flashbacky things that are sort of trying to make it more interesting and more dynamic. And the writer, for good reason, left out a lot of the detail that would have normally been in this type of story. So when Leslie and I looked at this, we're sort of like struggling to figure out like, well, how is this version of Jane Eyre going to either be more interesting or tell a better story or try to use some different narrative devices or narrative kind of methods, one of which is this sort of framing idea. And I don't think it succeeded in that. And the reason why I don't think it succeeded in that is because what a framing story does, which is what I like to think of as talking around the campfire, the context of what you're trying to get across is separated from the main story that you're trying to tell. So the first thing is the framing story is set up to support the next story that you're trying to tell. But it really doesn't have to have a huge amount of drive into the rest of the story. And this is confusing in this version. Since this is done out of order and in a nonlinear way, there's pieces that are missing that get confused. And in order to actually understand this movie, you have to know the original story. That, I don't think, is a great way to go. Although, of course, it's more interesting and, of course, it's more dramatic, but it gets muddled and you can't get your fingers around it. If you look at the way a traditional framing story would work, the best example is The Princess Bride, because clearly you've got the grandfather telling his grandson the story of Buttercup and Wesley. You don't need the framing story to tell the story. It is used to bring out another example or make another point. Now, the real critical factor here was that there is not enough space between what's happening to have a proper frame to set the different stories apart. They need each other. And that, I think, is a very critical mistake. When you need another part of the story that is not a framing story, it can't be separated. And you have to now do more work to get the reader, the viewer up to speed. And again, if you didn't know about Jane Eyre watching this version, you're going to get confused because they leave a lot of stuff out. So the thing that is important about this technique, the nonlinear pieces kin to flashback. The flashback portions, they're too long. Flashbacks typically are very short snippets that fill in context that may have taken place in the past. As a writer, if you are going to adapt something of this caliber, even though I know exactly why they did it, and even though you look on Rotten Tomatoes, it got 86%. Maybe just me. I didn't like it. But it confused me, and I think it really did confuse the nonlinear storytelling from the framing story. Leslie will talk a little bit more about kind of the nonlinear nature of this and how even then it sort of doesn't work as well as it could have.
Okay, since we're confessing things today, full disclosure, for me, Mr. Darcy will always be Colin Firth, and Mr. Rochester will always be Toby Stevens. That said, that's just the way it is for me. But that said, I've come to appreciate this adaptation for what it is, though it took me a little while to warm up to it. A couple of observations, it appears to me that the adaptation requires familiarity with the story or prior adaptations that are more linear to really get the point that I think the screenwriter was trying to make. It really helps to know some of the details that are left out of this version. To me, it feels like a short story that is really about Jane running from Thornfield, then staying with the Rivers family, and then returning to Northfield. Now, we're obviously given lots of backstory by way of explanation to provide context, but the middle build is not happening in the story's present. As I mentioned, there are a lot of details that I really enjoyed in the original novel that are missing from this version. And this is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's worth noting. It's as if we're given a taste of Jane's experiences at Lowood, at Thornfield Hall, and with the Rivers family. But there's some key details that are missing, particularly about Grace Poole, which goes a long way to explain the strange things that are happening in the home. And the fact that St. John and his sisters are actually Jane's cousins. Also, the origin of Adele is dealt with in not as much detail as in other adaptations and, of course, the story. So those are some observations about the adaptation. And I want to talk a little bit about nonlinear storytelling. Obviously, we get what this means. It means we're sharing story events out of chronological order. But why might we choose that? Humans generally have a preference for linear storytelling. So moving the events around has a jarring effect on the reader or viewer, and it pulls them out of the dream of the narrative. This is one of those things that requires master craft skills to keep the reader engaged in the story, wanting to read, you know, continue to go forward while taking them out of that narrative dream. One of the things that we're trying to do with nonlinear storytelling is we're not after the typical cause and effect relationship that's demonstrated by the controlling idea or theme of the story, as we talk about it in the Story Grid universe, but we're presenting alternative relationships, putting different events next to other events that are not connected in time or in cause and effect, because we want to perhaps create some logical argument or point the reader to a different conclusion. Now, we need a pretty good reason to choose it, something that outweighs the downside of pulling the reader out of the experience and still delivers a satisfying experience at the end. Now, a classic example of this are murder mysteries, because we have an interwoven linear and nonlinear story within the big story. Oftentimes, the line of investigation is happening in the conventional fashion. One thing leads to another thing leads to another thing as the amateur or professional detective puts together the story of the crime and whodunit as the clues arise. So the story of the crime evolves in a more nonlinear way, whereas the story of the investigation is actually happening generally in a linear fashion. Now, in other genres, the storytelling shifts the reader's focus from what's happening, again, that is the cause and effect, to something else, revealing something of the storytelling itself, which is something I found really interesting. It tends to be more allegorical, which we talked about in The Wizard of Oz, where something stands for something else. We're trying to make a point, as if the writer wants us to stay awake for clues that she's planted to bring us to a specific conclusion. John Gardner sums up this basic difference between linear and nonlinear plotting as exploration versus demonstration. So when I was, you know, all of these ideas were swimming around in my head after watching this adaptation, I thought about why the screenwriter might approach the structure in this way. And before I checked with secondary sources, because I didn't want to be influenced by the screenwriter's words herself, I came up with this kind of weird thing for your consideration. Strange as it sounds, to me, this structure seems to suggest that Jane got lucky. Mr. Rochester turns out to be a decent guy, though there's a lot of micro evidence about him not being a bad guy that's missing from the film. But given all that happened, his dishonesty, his willingness to jeopardize her legal standing as his wife, And just the way he's conducted himself, he's not quite a catch that she would have believed initially. And she might have been better off, or perhaps the average young woman would be better off dismissing the ghostly voice that called her and taking her chances by staying at the village school. Now, from an interview with the screenwriter, she was said that she was going for the gothic thriller angle rather than the love story, which to me casts the story in quite a different light and stays true to the spirit of the original, despite not having the screen time to include all the details that I mentioned. The screenwriter needed to solve some problems within the original story structure that could play well in the 1840s, but not so well in a 2-hour film in the 21st century. And part of that is the fact that the Rivers family, that's a whole new situation, whole new characters, are being introduced roughly 2/3 of the way through the story. And that doesn't work as well with audiences today. We're going to be talking actually about different nonlinear stories in this season. And you might be wondering, well, why do we see so many of these today or more often today than we would have in the past? And the thing to keep in mind is that changes in narrative method really reflect the way that we see and think about the world, because stories are our way of processing and making sense of the world. So, for example, storytelling has changed significantly since films and television have been introduced. Readers are a lot less tolerant of telling and demand more showing than you see in 19th century novels. Some of us are still rather fond of that and totally run with it. But when we're talking about more conventional readers, more conventional film goers, they want to be shown. Similarly, some people have commented that the rise in nonlinear storytelling could be a reflection of the live, real-time nature of life in the early 21st century, which sounds like a pretty good explanation to me.
That's awesome. This is really fun. I like sitting back here and being the moderator. All right, so I'm not going to say too much more. I'm going to let Kim and Anne jump in with their rebuttal because I'm really curious to hear what you guys have to say. Take it away, guys.
Okay, so full disclosure, I hadn't realized the difference between the narrative devices of a framing story versus the narrative device of a story that opens out of order. So narrative devices, I think, have been a blur for me, and I haven't had that really clear idea in my head about what my options are and the distinct nuances between them. So I just want to say a big thank you to Jari and Leslie for clarifying that and really pointing out to me and all of us the distinct difference between a framing device story like The Princess Bride versus a nonlinear story, which is, I realize, what we actually have here in Jane Eyre. It's not a framing device. It's a nonlinear storytelling. So that was really helpful to me. So interestingly, Jari and Leslie both mentioned that they really felt like that the film version kind of requires some pre-familiarity and knowledge with the story. But interestingly, this film, Jane Eyre 2011, was my first experience with Jane Eyre. I saw the film first and I had never read the book, and I absolutely loved the film. And after I watched it, I couldn't wait to read the book. And then I did, and it was very different and very wonderful. And I love them both for what they are. I love the sense of mystery and the pacing that I get from the film, but I love the drawn out ending that we get in the novel where Mr. Rochester recovers some of his sight, enough to see the blue of Jane's dress and his child's face. And it always leads me to so much crying. And once I read the book, Jane and Rochester, they became my favorite love story, even more than Pride and Prejudice. Jane and Rochester are tops for me. So it's these two characters, like they seize me in this visceral way, and I can't shake them. So I'm extremely biased on probably all versions of this story. So yeah, I love them both for exactly what they are. Two different ways to tell the same story. But whatever way you choose, you know, inherently changes the story. And that's just fascinating to me. You can take the same characters and events, you know, mostly, and that the order in which you tell them, you know, fundamentally changes the story, you know, that pattern of meaning that the audience gets. And determining how to tell it is a really interesting choice. And for myself and my own novel that is really close to being done, figuring out the how to tell it was a big obstacle. And I went over and over for a long, much too long of a time to figure out, you know, how to do this. You know, what's the narrative device? What POV? You know, where should I open the story? You know, these kinds of things about what's going to be the best way to tell the story. Because again, each option, it changed the story. It's like, oh, well, that could work, but that's a very different story than what I'm trying to tell. Or, well, this could work. And so just, you know, looking at all of those options and knowing which one feels the most right to me. So really, it comes down to, for me, in my novel, deciding what kind of story I really want to tell. What's my genre? But to get to genre, it's like the first thing I had to do was figure out what is it that I'm trying to tell, and then what genre fits what I'm trying to tell. And also knowing, you know, what you don't want to tell, I think is really helpful. And either answer is totally okay, as long as you're being really clear and honest with yourself. So looking at what are all the possible ways to tell your story, look at the pros and cons of each, as Leslie and Jari have mentioned, that, you know, there you give up some things when you tell nonlinear stories, and you give up some things when you tell a linear story. Like, they have pros and cons, just like everything. And that's why we have to put those creative limits on ourselves. Ultimately, I really feel like it comes down to connecting with what matters most to you. Why are you telling the story in the first place? What matters to you about it? And then find those things and let those things be your guide. It's your why for your story. It's the heart of what really matters. And to me, getting to that heart of this is what's so important to me, you know, in this case about Jane and her character, or about Rochester, or about their love for one another and how things come together, whatever that is. And in this case, Moira Buffini, she really wanted to go for that gothic thriller element, which is really interesting. So the way she told the story helps her deliver that feeling to it. And to me, all of that feels like your first genre, right? The heart of why. And then you go, okay, so if this is the heart of why I'm trying to tell the story, then what content genre helps me tell that story? What narrative device helps me tell that story? What point of view helps me tell that story? What beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff helps me tell that story, that visceral why feeling that I want readers to take away when they read it or watch it or whatever. Creative limits are really, really good for us. They help us generate better ideas and make decisions. And ultimately, they help us finish and get to done, which is always a win, and something that myself, and I know I'm sure all of you listening, we're really trying to get to. So just appreciating something for what it is and letting it stand on its own.
Amen. That was great, Kim. Thank you. I wanted to say something about Leslie's insights into how much of the novel was elided for the movie. And it brings me to some thoughts that I'm still kind of trying to pin down. They have to do with what a novel is. And I don't have a solid definition. I'm sure there are several out there if I wanted to Google it. But one thing a novel is not is a movie. Okay, and we've struggled with this difference throughout the podcast because most of us and most of our listeners, I think, are probably novelists. There are some screenwriters among us too. There's a lot in common between the two forms, and all of the story grid principles apply to them both. And sometimes I think we all wonder whether, because of that, the written form is just dying a slow death because movies and shows are so much easier from the audience perspective to just consume, right? But I wanted to call attention to episode 82 of the Allusionist podcast. It's a podcast about language, and if you're not listening to it, you should. It's wonderful. And I'll post a link, of course. This episode looks into the unique healing powers of reading a novel. The blurb says, when you're feeling unwell, what's the book you read to make yourself feel better, and why does it work? In this episode, a clinical psychologist explains why she sometimes prescribes novel reading to her patients, how attachment to characters in a story can take them out of OCD behaviors. Now, this psychologist is specific about reading rather than watching TV or movies because of the role that active participation plays in reading. The reader controls the speed of unfolding, and the act of imagining and connecting with characters, she says, is cognitively different from any other form. Reading is more soothing and paradoxically more actively demanding, and therefore more healing for people with anxiety or obsessive thoughts. So this episode of the podcast of The Allusionist really helped me think about why written stories are still important. And as we on our podcast move into season 4, I plan to really look into what novels are for and how movies, as wonderful as they are not equivalent. And I'm looking forward to talking more about that.
Thank you so much. Okay, this has been a really interesting episode for me. And I'm wondering what the listeners think of this. Has our analysis of Jane Eyre helped you better understand what a framing story is and how it works as a narrative device, and how it is maybe similar to or different than the device of nonlinear storytelling. Have you ever analyzed a story using either of these devices? And if so, how did you handle it? Is there a novel or film that you think is an excellent example of a framing story or a story that uses a non-linear storytelling technique? Let us know on Twitter at StoryGridRT. Okay, to wind up the episode, we take questions from our listeners. This week's question comes to us from Joanne. Let's have a listen.
Hi, I've just discovered the Story Grid a couple weeks ago and have been binge listening like mad. And I also want to try and learn to apply these principles. And I was watching Marvel's Doctor Strange movie this weekend for the very first time. And I suddenly saw the scene in the middle and I go, I think that's the speech in praise of the villain. And it's the scene where the villain starts bending everything the way Doctor Strange's mentor was able to at the beginning. So I'm wondering, though, is this really the speech in praise of the villain? Because technically speaking, the villain isn't doing more than the mentor was at the beginning. The villain can do more than Doctor Strange can. So Doctor Strange is sort of at the mercy of the villain. But is the villain really able to do that much more than the mentor? And does that then not count as a speech in praise of the villain because they're not more powerful than the mentor? Thank you.
That's a really fun question, Joanne. You gave me an excuse to revisit Doctor Strange. It's not Marvel's greatest movie, but it's a lot of fun. And it does hew very closely to the hero's journey and follows the conventions and obligatory scenes of an action story. So it's a very good one to study. The speech in praise of the villain has one major job to do, and that is to disclose in no uncertain terms to the audience and probably also to the hero that the villain has more power than the hero. If we don't have that information before the ending payoff, we as the audience have no reason to fear for the hero or worry about the victim. We've hit on a very good insight, though, about action stories with fantasy elements, and that's that the mentor and the villain can sometimes have similar powers, like Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader, or maybe Saruman and Gandalf in Lord of the Rings, because they studied under the same master or at the same, you know, Hogwarts or whatever. So in cases like that, where the mentor figure and therefore the hero have similar powers to those of the villain, the villain's speech in praise has to show that his motives are what give him or her the edge. So in the case of Doctor Strange, I think the speech in praise of the villain comes right after the big fight scene that you mentioned. At about an hour and 2 minutes in, Caecilius, the villain whom Strange has temporarily bound, explains that he's really the good guy, trying to save the world, working for an even greater godlike good guy who is going to be all benevolence. It has all the cliche earmarks of its kind. As the camera pushes in on the bad guy's face, he gives a long monologue, and the hero skeptically but inexplicably lets him talk, which I always think is a funny part of that. Of that convention. By the way, the fight scene that you mentioned is the obligatory action story scene called The Hero's Initial Strategy Against the Villain Fails. It falls into the tests, allies, and enemies phase of the hero's journey. Doctor Strange puts his new powers to the test against Caecilius in that scene and quickly realizes that he's not yet masterful enough to defeat him. In that process, he's granted his special weapon, which is another trope of the hero's journey, which allows him to escape and fight another day. So thanks for an excellent question. I hope this has been of some help to you in thinking it through. And keep on watching those straightforward action movies to really understand story structure.
Thanks, Anne, and thanks, Joanne. If you have a question about framing stories, nonlinear storytelling, narrative devices, or any other story principle, you can ask it on Twitter at StoryGridRT, or better still, do what Joanne did by going to storygrid.com/resources, clicking on the Editor Roundtable podcast, and leaving us a voice message. That wraps it up for this week. Thank you, Anne, Jari, Kim, and Leslie, for your excellent editorial insights, as always, into Jane Eyre. We hope our discussion has given you a better grasp of how to incorporate framing stories and nonlinear devices and other narrative devices into your own stories. You can find links and additional material in the show notes at storygrid.com. If you're interested in hiring a certified StoryGrid editor or would like to find out more about what we do, visit storygrid.com/editing. If you want to connect with one of us directly, our links can be found in the show notes. If you'd like to support the show, you can do that by telling other writers about us and by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Join us next time when Anne challenges us to examine the 2010 Christopher Nolan science fiction heist drama, Inception, for, you guessed it, another discussion on non-linear narrative device, nested stories. And I'm on her team next week, so this will be interesting. Why not give it a look during the week and follow along with us? Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.
Still having fun.
Still having fun.
Still having fun.